Today's podcast is brought to you by Workin, a division of Aviante. Founded in 2015, Workin is the leader for customer experience, tech innovation in the staffing industry, and plays the role of strategic partner by offering state-of-the-art software solutions designed to create a five-star experience for staffing agencies, employers, and the workforce. We appreciate Workin's commitment to advancing DEI initiatives in the staffing industry. They're a proud sponsor of the American Staffing Association's Women's Leadership Interest Group and IDEA Interest Group. Learn more at workin.com. On this episode of the Edge Podcast, ClearEdge CEO and founder Leslie Vickery interviews Henna Pryor, CEO and founder of executive coach and leadership training company Priority Group. Leslie and Henna discuss how humor can be a tool for confidence, the importance of claiming your achievements, and how fear is a mask for desire. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Edge Podcast. I am your host, Leslie Vickery, CEO and founder of Clear Edge Marketing. For those of you new to the Edge, we feature executive women in the recruitment industry in an effort to shine the light on the wonderful women leading our industry forward. And for up-and-comers, if they can see it, women in executive roles and understand the day in the life of the C-suite, they can certainly envision it and be it. For today's episode, it brings me great pleasure to welcome Henna Pryor, president and founder of Priority Group, member of Chief and Limitless Minds, and former recruiting director for K-Force, where she spent 14 years. I happened to first meet Henna through our mutual friend, Casey Jaycox, and have been thoroughly impressed by her since. I always walk away from our conversations not only energized and inspired, but also full of ideas. I hope you feel the same after today's conversation. Welcome, Henna.
Thank you, Leslie. Such a sweet introduction. Thank you so much.
So with that, Henna, we're actually going to mix things up today. And I've asked Lyric Copeland, who helps produce The Edge, to join me in interviewing you. We recently had you join ClearEdge for a lunch and learn, and that's where we bring in industry experts to help educate and train our team. During your presentation, Lyric was very busy sending me Slack messages, encouraging me to invite you to our podcast because she was so impressed and just excited to hear you talk, and what you were saying really resonated. And again, not only with Lyric, but our entire team, I received so much positive feedback. And of course, I said, yes, absolutely. I love Henna. Let's get her on the show. And here you are today. So I've actually asked Lyric to help me today. We're going to co-host this podcast together and interviewing you. So Lyric.
Hi, Henna. I'm so happy you could be here with us today.
I'm so excited that you get to do the interviewing.
Well, let's start with your background, and I'd love it if you could just share some specifics around your company and how you got started on your entrepreneurial journey.
Sure. So I started my career, just backing up a bit, in the biggest of the big companies. I worked for a big four public accounting firm, Ernst & Young, right out of school, and pivoted that career to K-Force, as you mentioned, where I spent 14 years. And I often get the question, what made you leave K-Force? You were there for so long. They were so good to you. It seemed like you really loved it. And I sort of answer that with yes, yes, and yes. I didn't burn out. I didn't leave because I started to hate it. I didn't leave because it no longer suited me. I just was very hungry to try something new. And there was always a part of me that was itching to really hang my own hat and do something my way. But also another part of me that had been told for a number of years in staffing that while I was everyone's staffing partner, that I was also their sort of de facto executive coach. They would say, hey, you know, we don't pay you to do coaching, but we really use you as that. And so finally, at one point, I had this moment of, what's a coach? What is that? That's a job? Which led me to getting my coaching certification. And that led me to starting my own company where I do keynote speaking, sales and performance training and development, and executive coaching and facilitation.
I feel like you are a speaker at just about every industry event these days. So it's nice to see your name. I remember the very first event we attended together, which was the ASA Thrive Women in Staffing mm-hmm. and Leadership and Event. And since then, I feel like we've been in lockstep everywhere we go, which has been so much fun. Again, a big thank you to Casey for bringing us together and yeah. really just the mark that you're making on the industry as a whole. So with that, Henna, we're actually going to turn it over to Lyric and have her take over the next couple of questions. Lyric.
So as many of us know, what we get our degrees in isn't always the path we end up taking in our careers. I started my adult life pursuing the arts, but ended up completing a marketing and storytelling course at Berkeley, which propelled me into a completely different industry. You got your bachelor's in finance and a master's in accounting and started your career as an auditor at EY, later making a complete 180 when you decided to venture into the world of staffing, later landing a recruiting director and career strategist role at Kforce. When deciding to take that leap and make that change, I'm curious about your headspace. What kind of questions did you ask yourself? What were you considering?
Great question. I'll answer the first one, which is my headspace. So at the time, I was 23 years old. So the answer was scared to death, scared out of my mind. I had worked for EY, which was, you know, a big international recognized company, one that my wonderful immigrant parents were very proud to tell their friends that I worked for. And I was considering leaving for a 100% commission job at Kforce. So it was terrifying. But what I'll say is I've never been one to let fear stop me from doing things. It's something that I've always had a little bit of, you know, it's grown over the years, but I've found a lot of success in my professional career through pivots. I'll start by saying, I don't know that it was a complete 180. I think a pivot is different from a 180. When I think of a complete 180, I almost think of a game of roulette, right? Let's like spin the wheel and see where we should go. Let's go that way. Okay, let's try it. Whereas a pivot is when you're more intentional about capitalizing on some of the skills you already have while making a strategic turn in another direction. What types of questions did I ask myself? What was I considering? Most of us, I think, when we're thinking about a career juncture or career crossroads, I think most people have heard this advice to ask, what's my passion? I don't like that question, actually. I think when you start with passion, it assumes that you're at the center of the world and everything else needs to fall in line and revolve around you. Sometimes it's a good question to ask if you're really clear on it, but sometimes the better question, at least for me at age 23, was, where can you find your greatest contribution? That question really landed for me. When you start with, what do people around me need? You can kind of reverse engineer it to who you are and what your strengths are. What are the holes and gaps that haven't been filled? Look at the demand. What are your natural talents and unique strengths? So I got this from a book called Life's Great Question by Tom Rath. And so he says to draw a line between what are my strengths and what does the world need? And back yourself into your career from there.
That's a really cool idea. Something else that often comes with making that kind of dramatic change or pivot, as you said, is an overlap of skills. So with my background in the arts, I'm a creative person and I like finding ways to bring that creativity to my work at ClearEdge. Are there any attributes that have supported you in finance and staffing? What were they and how can people start leaning into their unique skills at work?
I think that's actually precisely what makes a pivot work. It's when people reach really, really, really outside of some of their skills and what they've done that maybe they have a bigger learning curve when they try to take on a new career. But when you do find those couple of things where there is overlap, absolutely, that's where you're going to find success in any kind of career change or a pivot. In finance and staffing, even though they seem different, in my case, there were definitely some very clear similarities. One being that I started my staffing career working on finance and accounting roles, right? I didn't want to reinvent all of my knowledge from scratch. So that was a very natural overlap. There's other things too. You know, both professions require a pretty keen attention to detail. Both professions, I would argue, are future focused. With finance, you're looking ahead at financial projections and plans. In staffing, you're helping create someone's career, or you're helping create the right next hire. And the last overlap that I think really strikes me is, again, maybe not obvious to some when you think about finance, but really both of these careers have an element of storytelling. In finance, you're trying to articulate to non-financial people, what is the result and why does it matter? And in staffing, which inevitably is sales, It's the exact same thing. What is the result? What is the outcome you're going to get? Why does it matter? Why would it be a good idea for you? So anytime you can find those overlaps, you are definitely more likely to be successful in a pivot.
That makes a lot of sense. I love thinking about just the book that you mentioned and pivoting and the different skill sets that it takes, and not to always think about the passion, but what people need. I have to admit, I hadn't really thought of that in the past, and it really struck me and is something I'm going to take into consideration in interviewing people and talking to people and mentoring and so forth. I'm going to dig into that with you a little later at another time. But for now, I want to chat a little bit on your LinkedIn profile. You have a Marshall Goldsmith quote: "What got you here won't get you there." Marshall is the co-author of a book I mention, I want to say almost every single podcast. So we'll say a lot of podcasts, which is called How Women Rise. I love talking about it because it details the 12 habits holding women back from their next, it could be a raise, a promotion, or a job. And some of the faves that I hear quite often and quite frankly resonated with me personally could be things like reluctance to claim your achievements, expecting others to spontaneously notice and reward your contributions. I hear that one all the time. You have to be comfortable pushing and being your own champion, failing to enlist allies, putting your job before your career. The perfection trap, disease to please, minimizing, ruminating. I could go on and on. With that said, I'm curious, which one or few of these habits did you recognize in yourself? And what did you change to move up and on in your career?
All of them. I think that's it. Most of us will answer that way, almost all of them. But getting a handle on a few of them really changed my life. So the first is the very first one you mentioned, which is reluctance to claim my achievements. And I realized that this was deeply rooted from childhood, and I would even argue potentially at a cultural level. My parents are immigrants. I'm first generation born in the United States, and they're very hardworking, the soil that they sowed was what has resulted in my sister and I having the opportunities that we had. But they were very big on humility and not bragging. And we don't want to put these things out in the world, because in Pakistani culture, there's something called nazar, which is sort of like the evil eye. When you brag, people are going to look at you and they're going to wish ill on you. And so you don't want to do that. And so for a long time, I did not want people to know about my successes or wins for fear that my mom and dad had instilled in me about this nazar, right? People are going to think something about me. And what I realized is it's not self-promotional to claim your achievements. In fact, you're making yourself visible. It's visibility creation to claim your achievements. I still will find a little bit of a rub when I think someone is being unnecessarily self-promotional, being boastful or maybe tone deaf in the way that they describe something, not realizing that maybe they had a head start. But that's very different than just owning your wins. It's not bragging if you've done it. It's not bragging if it's actually part of your history. That's just cataloging what already happened. Reluctance to claim your achievements is one that I'm happy to say is behind me. I now openly and boldly share my achievements. And I realize not only is that best in service of me, but it's best in service of the people I serve. And the comparison I always make is, if I need to hire a painter for my kitchen, am I going to go on Google, or am I more likely going to ask all my neighbors, hey, who's a painter that did a really good job for you all? And if they all say, oh, it was this person, it was that person, that's exactly the type of noise I need people to make on my behalf, because I'm much more likely to get the business. So claiming it, owning it, let other people claim it on your behalf. That's one. And the second one is, I loved the one about letting your radar distract you. It is a skill to learn how to tune out the noise in service of a goal. And I'm a huge lover. I'm a huge reader in general, but I'm a huge lover of James Clear. And I love his quote about, you don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. Women are intuitive. We can read the room. We can see someone over here is fidgeting. We can see something over here is happening. But if your systems are set up around you such that you are constantly paying attention to all this stimuli, it is really hard to stay laser focused on what you want to do. So one of the skills that's really served me in the last couple of years, especially, is learning how to tune out the noise, just even for a period of time, in order to serve a goal. And I find that I'm much more likely to hit the goals that I want to hit if I can do that.
Well, we now have a couple of books that you've referenced. Lyric, I think we need to create a resource.
I can't promise I'm done yet either.
I love, you know, Henna, that you basically said every single one of them, because at any certain point in your career, or your life, certainly we've all experienced some, if not all of these. But something that you mentioned that really stood out to me, and as part of the book, they say, don't try to overcome all of these at once. And if it's even just one, two, three at a time, make it manageable so you can kind of celebrate that success and see that change and really let it stick and become a habit for you and part of your DNA and who you are as you continue to grow and mature.
100%.
All right. Lyric, let's turn it back over to you.
Thanks. And thanks, Anna, for that last answer. Mm-hmm. It's not bragging if you've done it really stood out to me. And it also has to do with my next question. So another theme discussed in How Women Rise is our motivators and how women aren't as enticed by money and titles as they are by self-growth and helping others succeed. Because of this, professional women are often left feeling unsatisfied with their accomplishments and never experience the feeling of I've arrived, right? So within your 14 years at K-Force alone, you received many accolades, including K-Force Diamond Club Performer of the Year, Gold Level Performer, and Rookie of the Year. How did you balance this recognition with feeling like you still needed to do more at that point in your career?
So I'm going to first give you a confession. I love being recognized. I love it. I love it. It feels so good. I live for it. My natural wiring is that I'm an insatiably hungry person. I don't know if anyone listening is familiar with the Enneagram, but I'm a 7, which is a type that's often associated with kind of wanting more always, you know, always seeking the next thrill, the next adventure, the next accolade. I recognize this about myself. This is very much how I am. But when my kids were born, I had a reckoning. You know, I had to redefine what does success mean to me. And one of the things that really became clear once I became a mother is at my funeral, will former peers and coworkers attend and will they say, here lies Henna, Diamond Club Performer of the Year? No, unlikely, right? I want them to say, man, Henna really gave me her full attention when I needed it, or I always felt like she cared, or man, she kept her performance up. And even though she wasn't number one anymore, she worked in a way that felt an integrity to her and was still a hands-on mom. So I think that balance of recognition and high performance and this feeling that you still need to do more, for me, the solution to that, or the way that I have to constantly, I have to have this conversation with myself daily, is really getting clear on what does success mean to me in this moment in time? And you have to be able to answer that really honestly for yourself.
And as women, how can we better check the facts to claim our accomplishments along the way?
Oh, well, I love, you know, we just talked about kind of this reluctance to claim our accomplishments. One quote I heard a couple of years back was, you master what you measure, which means cataloging those darn things, right? Catalog your wins. Do it daily, do it weekly, not just at the end of the year during performance review season, because I'll tell you what, I'm not going to remember half of it, but also psychologically, there's so much benefit. So I try to do daily, at least writing down one win, no matter how microscopic it may feel, but what's one small win? And then at the end of the week, I try to acknowledge what are three small wins or three big wins, any wins that I had that week. And what's useful about that is not only is there, you know, tons of research that supports the psychological benefit, but we're all going to have those days where we don't feel so confident. We don't feel so good. We don't feel so accomplished. And then we have a running record that we can go back and remind ourselves, hey, we are doing some things. We are accomplishing some things. And it really helps to see it written and kind of staring us in the face to remind us of what the reality and the facts are versus what our emotions might be telling us in that moment.
Okay. I have to ask you, Henna, how do where do you keep track of all of these things?
A very not fancy Google Doc is where I keep it. It's not, it's not even formatted very cute. It's pretty sloppy, but it gets the job done.
I feel like I have so many different with devices and pads of paper and whatever. I need to find a place to kind of bring it all together and in general. All right, let's shift gears for a second to talk a little bit about mentors. And you know, this is something really important to me, so much so I had started a company with two of my best friends, founded on this topic with Aura Mentors, which is attract, retain, and enhance women in technology. So sometimes, Hannah, asking the right questions, that's all you need a mentor to do. And then from there, you're able to reflect and determine what's important for you and your next kind of career life and move. Can you remember any conversations you've had with the mentor that was pivotal in your career or life? And what was it upon remembering that, and how did you take action?
It's hard to narrow down to one, to be honest. Lots of them, but I feel so fortunate that I've been blessed with many great mentors over the years. But one of the conversations that definitely has stuck with me was during my executive coach training a couple of years ago. So the co-professor and I were doing sort of a practice session together, and I had been sharing an experience about something. There was something I was trying to do that I had been waffling about for a while. Couldn't get off the fence, right? And she asked me, "What is the cost of that to you?" And that is a question that no one had ever asked me before. And it knocked me over. I had never thought of things that way. And I can't tell you the amount of times I've now used that question both with myself, with my clients, because I realized that every choice comes with a cost associated. And by choosing this, you don't choose that, right? So just tactical example, by choosing to work later into the evening, I'm choosing not to spend that time with my children. By choosing to create this spreadsheet, I'm choosing not to have this meeting with this client. You know, most of us do that quick analysis in lightning speed in our brains, but actually forcing myself to name the choice, to name the cost associated with that choice, has been so helpful to guide any decision-making I do in my life. And I now ask myself that question before I do any big decision-making. I want to add just one more, which is similar, but another question that I was asked in that training that I use all the time. And it is, in my opinion, one of the best and frankly rudest questions that I've ever been asked, which was, how are you complicit in creating the conditions in your life that you say you don't want? And when I was asked that, I had this reaction of, how dare you, right? And also, excuse my language, but God damn it, right? You're right. How am I complicit in creating the conditions in my life that I say I don't want? And when you're forced to answer that question honestly with yourself, you'd be amazed at the transformation and how it helps drive your decisions.
Well, you're certainly surrounded by some strong mentors, because those both have me thinking. My brain went to even next week with some decisions I'm trying to make already and thinking through, gosh, what would the cost of that be? So thank you for that. I always think about Joyce Russell. She was on our podcast, now the president of Adecco US Foundation, and she uses the 10-10-10 theory. And it reminds me a little bit about that, which is, when you're making a decision, what will the impact be in 10 minutes, 10 months, and 10 years? Yes. And she uses that a lot when making even personal decisions, but that's been helpful for me. You just gave me a couple more tools. So thank you, Hannah, on giving me feedback and advice. Okay. I know you're working with a lot of leaders right now, and we talked a little bit about fears earlier as well. I'd be curious what you've learned about the fears of executive women and how they combat them.
So I have two thoughts on fear. First one is, the biggest is, even at the executive level, there is always still a little bit of a healthy fear of taking risks. And depending on what level you are at, that's going to look and sound different. But it's still some form of stepping up, speaking out in case we get it wrong. Anytime we step forward to take a risk professionally, I heard someone describe it once as, it feels like a psychological undressing, right? We feel so exposed. And if we expose ourselves, we're making ourselves vulnerable to criticism, which, no matter how we're raised, still most of us are wired to love to avoid that. We don't want that. But there is a paradox here. You know, most executive women are ambitious. They're hungry to become top performers. They want it really badly, which, because they want it really badly, it creates some anxiety and fear around getting it wrong. But at the same time, that anxiety and fear actually shoots up your resistance, to achieving your goal. So one of the things that we can do to get comfortable is start to just embrace these conflicting intentions. To be a successful leader, we need to get comfortable with that inner voice telling us to avoid situations where we might be criticized or laughed at or rejected and keep pushing forward. And ultimately, that choice is between, do we want results or do we want approval? And we have to draw a line in the sand around which one we want in any given moment. You know, sometimes it's approval, but often it's results, right? The second thought I have on fear, and this came from one of my own coaches, is that fear is a mask for desire. If we're really afraid, it's probably a sign that it really matters to us and it's something that we really, really want. And if that fear is holding you back, it's good to just remind ourselves that many of those troubles, many of these worries never actually happen, and that holding back is a form of self-protection. But if we're not careful, it can turn into self-sabotage. If we are afraid, it's not always a bad thing. It's just a mask for desire, but that success is on the other side of that comfort zone.
I was listening to a podcast with Brené Brown and Dolly Parton, of all things. And Dolly Parton was talking about exactly what you're referencing, where the desire should be greater than the fear, and to remember to focus on the desire and the excitement and not to let the fear hold you back. So that end result that you're talking about should be able to overcome any fears that you have. Another roadblock, and you mentioned a little bit about the fear piece when we were talking about it, I kept thinking about confidence. And this is something that comes up often when we host events where there's a lack of confidence, oftentimes with women. And it could stem from many, many different things, something from childhood, something that happened professionally, just over the years, something that just continues to grow within someone can be a real challenge. In fact, I remember a survey we did with ARA for Women in Tech. It was the number one piece of advice that men and women each had for women was to be more confident. And I know we talk often about the greatest gift you can give your children is the gift of confidence. So is there any specific advice or an activity to help face these challenges for women who you have worked with specifically when it comes to confidence?
Yes, definitely. And I, first of all, I have to laugh. Don't you love it when someone says to you, to be more confident? You're like, okay, sure. Right. I'll get right on that. Right.
Yeah,
exactly. If it was that easy, we would all be just walking in confidently with our heads held high. So I have lots of advice that I give both in coaching and consulting conversations, but I'm going to give you three of my favorite pieces of advice. Actually, maybe four. The first one is to use humor. And this one surprises people sometimes. Humor is a really powerful tool in your toolkit when you're trying to develop your confidence. So here comes another book that I loved. There's a book that recently came out in the last year by two Stanford professors called Humor Seriously. It's by Naomi Bagdonis and Jennifer Acker. And they study humor in business. And what they found is that using humor in the correct ways can help you say the things that you want to say while not worrying so much about the outcome. So I'll give you just a quick example. In the book, they talk about there was a woman who was sitting in these meetings that were mostly men. So it was her with a table full of men. And she found out that after the meeting, the men would go into the bathroom and almost like continue the meeting. They'd continue to have the discussion. And this was bugging her. So in the next meeting, she said, "Gents, next time you continue the meeting after the meeting in the bathroom, I'm going to follow you in there," right? She used humor to say the thing, the hard thing that she wanted to say, but it worked like a charm. It used a different tactic to get the same point across. So I love the use of humor to develop confidence. I also love pumping yourself up with a question. There's always emphasis on self-talk, right? Do we have good self-talk? Is there positive self-talk? Silent words that we say to ourselves before doing something important. And so the old view, which is still has its place, is the, you know, positive, you can do this, you've got this. And research shows that that does work a little. It's better than nothing, but a better option is interrogative self-talk, which is instead of saying, "Hey, you got this," it's asking yourself, "Can you do this? And if so, how can you do this?" And it reminds you to have this moment of, Yes, you know, I've done this before. Draw in a previous experience. Okay, this is what I need to do, one step at a time. Becomes a little bit of a game that you can kind of talk yourself into the thing with a little more comfort. The third one I love is this idea. It's a psychology term, but I'll explain it. It's called anxious reappraisal, which is instead of saying, I'm nervous about giving this speech or I'm nervous about presenting today, you reframe it as, you know, I'm excited about giving this presentation today. And this actually, people kind of poo-poo this one. It works really well because nervousness and excitement are actually extremely similar. Both of them are high arousal emotions. One of them is negative and one of them is positive. But being calm is actually a low arousal emotion. And it's actually really hard to move from high to low. So it's easier to reappraise and turn what feels like a threat into an opportunity. So it's actually easier to go from nervous to excited than it is to go from nervous to calm. And the last tip I'll give, just tactical, is for those that are still building their confidence, just one really great tactical piece of advice I learned was don't speak in absolutes. Sometimes we're afraid to speak up because we're worried someone's going to disagree with us. So first I'd say there's always a chance that someone will disagree, even if you're unequivocally right. That's just going to happen sometimes, no matter what. But one confidence building technique is to leave room for perspective and not speak in absolutes. For example, if I stand up in a meeting and say, accounting never gets me this report on time, then I've created a hole that's easy for someone to poke through. Someone could refute that. But instead, if I say, accounting rarely gets me this report on time, there's some room there. You know, you can use some qualifying statements like, it's often the case that, or it seems to me that, as your help building your confidence. But I do have to clarify, that's different than minimizing. In the book, How Women Rise, they talk about don't minimize. You don't want to minimize. Don't do the, I'm just guessing here. That's minimizing. But you can give yourself qualifying statements like, I see it's often the case that, da, da, da. But try a qualifying statement if it helps you speak it into the room. Better that you qualify it versus not say it at all.
Okay, I could talk to you all afternoon on here and have you keep going on the topic of confidence. I know, Lyric, we're going to talk a little bit about something that is extraordinarily important to our industry in the recruitment space and something I talk about from time to time as well. So, Lyric, I'll have you tee up the next question.
Perfect. I know Leslie actually shares this stat a lot on the podcast, but we think it's so important. In our industry right now, female employees make up 48% of entry-level positions, but when you get to the C-suite, that number drops to 21%, with only 4% representing women of color. I personally was raised by a single mother and watched firsthand as she went to night school, worked extremely long hours, and often worked on weekends, all to prove herself to a male-dominated workforce with the hopes of getting a chance to succeed. Of course, work-life balance expectations have shifted a lot since then, but seeing what it took coupled with hearing this stat often is worrisome for me. I have my own dreams and aspirations, as do many other professional women. As a coach, how can mid-tier female leaders position themselves for greater success in an industry that's statistically holding them back?
Such a good question. And there's so many factors that play into this. Our own behavior, but also the systems that are surrounding us. But I'll try to answer from the lens of what can we do, because we can't necessarily control our systems. So some of the things that we can do are, I'm going to give you my favorite tips. First and foremost is I propose that we get rid of the phrase work-life balance from every female leader's vocabulary, because it'll never happen. It's not a thing. I like to use different words. I like the words work-life harmony or work-life integration. Because when you come at it from that place, you realize it's a dance. It'll always be a dance. For those of us that are mid-tier leaders that are looking to move up, some of us have families, some of us don't, some of us have hobbies, it will always be a dance. So if we can start reframing for work-life harmony or integration instead of balance, I think that will always help people be able to rise faster. One of the ones I struggle with the most, but I think is really important, is getting better at letting go of control. A lot of times when a mid-tier female leader is trying to be everything to everyone, it really has to do with control. When we say, man, we can't do everything, what we mean is we can't do everything at 100%. the way that we want to. And so control is a result of being attached to a specific outcome, the outcome that we had in our heads, as if we know what's best. So for example, if I have an image in mind of the type of working mother I want to be, the one who packs homemade healthy lunch every day, and then I make myself crazy trying to fulfill that 100%, it's never going to work. I'm attached to that specific outcome as being the right way. So the first thing we can do is start to ease up on ourselves and to choose our battles and realize that you can't be 100% of everything at any given moment. The math doesn't work. Understand that your pie slices will change and start to view each day as a new dance. That's how we start to give ourselves that muscle to continue to rise as things get harder and harder. And the last one I'll say is just play the long game. Perspective taking is really helpful. Leslie mentioned it earlier that Joyce talks about the 10-10-10 rule. We severely overestimate what we're going to do in 1 year, and we tend to underestimate what we'll do in 10 years. As a mid-tier leader who's got big dreams, don't beat yourself up over one lost day. When you look back, will that day have derailed things as much as you thought? Probably not. So those are my key tips.
Thank you for that. It's such an important topic to me. And I love that point. We're so hard on ourselves with what we didn't accomplish in a day or in that week. And we really need to keep that long-term view in mind and also be forgiving of ourselves as much as possible. We're all just doing the best that we can. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, to become a professional coach, one thing is for certain, Henna, you need a strong personal brand. And if you want to do it well, you have to be genuine in your efforts. So your tagline is, "I'm your secret for impossible change," which I think is genius. Can you share your personal branding story? And listen, I know you've helped others to give them feedback and advice and so forth, but I want to hear about your personal branding story and how you went about developing one.
Oh, so developing a personal brand is exactly that. It's so personal, but I truly believe, and I'm going to sound very self-motivated when I say this, but it starts from a place of deep, deep self-awareness. So I believe, you know, again, take the bias out of it because I am a coach, but I believe everyone should have a chance to do a deep dive with a coach at least once at some point. I learned more about myself in a few sessions than I did in years previous to that, just because I was able to have someone trained reflect things about me back to me. And it's really hard to see our own superpowers in the light of day. We're just too close to it. So it's much easier for someone else to reflect them back to us. One exercise I love, just as you're trying to ideate your own personal brand, is a superpowers collection. And that's, don't try to think about it yourself. Email 10 people you know and who you trust and ask them, "What are my superpowers? What do I do uniquely well? What feels missing the moment I walk out of the room?" It's so much easier to develop your personal brand once you get clear on what makes you unique. And the last thing I'd add is just, especially in this digital world, I teach this in my trainings, and I know I had talked about this when I was with the ClearEdge team, but write like you talk. Be authentically you in everything that you write on social media and every piece of collateral that you create. Don't make that voice a different version of the you that shows up in conversation every day. As closely as you can mirror your tone, your voice, your style in your writing, your personal brand will speak itself into the room so much more solidly and so much stronger than if you try to put on a voice that doesn't match the way you show up every day.
I love this feedback, Henna, especially the piece about what's missing. First of all, polling people to get their feedback is a brilliant idea. And then also, I love this question, what feels missing when I walk out of the room? It's just all of these things just make you stop in your tracks, think about it for a minute. And even just to proactively share that with people as well, I think is really powerful. And to write like you talk, it's a real skill to try to not over engineer when you're writing and to really just write it as if you're saying it in your head, or just even say it out loud, whatever it takes to practice that. It's a real skill set and one that you've mastered and you make look really, really easy, Henna, online. So
thank you.
I have to ask you though, because of that, it can feel really really daunting, right? If someone's thinking about, gosh, I follow henna and she's everywhere and look at, I mean, it really, if you think about what you've accomplished since starting your company in just a short amount of time where you are just about everywhere. And I know even after, it was so funny, after you did our company meeting, I jumped on a client call and said, oh, you're having this struggle on the recruiting front. You should be working with henna. Do you know henna prior? And they said, actually, we do. We're working with her. We just met with her this morning. So I feel like you really are everywhere. But for some people getting started on building their personal brand and so forth, it can feel daunting. What advice would you have just to get started? What could make it feel a little bit easier going into it? What are some of the very first steps someone could take where they don't need to feel like they went from A to where you are right now?
Sure. No. And they shouldn't have to. I mean, the catch 22, or maybe the surprising part when people take my training, is that I almost ask them to do the thing that's opposite of what they think. They think I'm going to teach them this new methodology for how to show up, this new methodology for how to write. And when they realize that really the trick is to be more you, they kind of have this, wait, what? You know, it's very confusing. And so what I would say is there's a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of conflicting advice on the internet. And when we get pulled into what sounds good or what's sexy in the moment, none of it sounds authentic when you try to wear someone else's brand. None of it does. And so the real version of kind of getting started on a personal branding journey starts with starting small. You don't need to write paragraphs. It could be a LinkedIn or Facebook post that's one or two sentences of something that you observed that day, something that you happen to notice or opinion that you have that's uniquely you. The more you can access your own voice and bring that to the conversation, the easier and simpler it gets. The reason for some people it's so painful is they're overthinking it so much and trying to sound like someone else. It sounds simplistic, but it's just returning to your roots that makes it feel easier.
Fantastic. Henna, thank you so much. I don't even want to say these words, but we are out of time. You have been phenomenal. And Lyric, thank you so much. First time having a guest host. Definitely want to bring you back. Thank you for joining us, adding your insights and questions and mixing things up a little bit here. Such a fun session. Henna, if people would like to get in touch with you, what's your preferred method?
Oh, LinkedIn is always great. That is where, if we're talking personal brand, that's where I like to contribute the most. And my website is www.prioritygroup.com. I'm always happy to make new friends, so I would love to chat with anyone.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us here today, Henna.
Thank you. Great job, Lyric.
Thanks, Henna.
Thanks for listening to The Edge. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate and subscribe to it in iTunes. Feel free to email Leslie at lvickery@clearedgemarketing.com and let us know if you have questions, would like to be a guest or suggest a potential guest, or share topics you'd like to see in the future.